history?
November 1st, 88, in my office.
So, go ahead.
Okay, well, I'm Francis Bonner. I'm in the Department of Chemistry, professor of chemistry. I came to the university in 1958. It was then the first Oyster Bay, and I was 36 years old at the time. This makes me now 66.
66.
I came to to Stony Brook from an industrial position. I was working for the Arthur D. Little Company in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and had been working in industry for a period of about 3 years. Prior to that, I had been in an academic position at Brooklyn College in the City University of New York.
Let me see how this...
Okay, I had been at Brooklyn College and had spent 1 year as a visiting assistant professor at Harvard before that. The person that was primarily responsible for my coming to Stony Brook was Leonard Olson. The way it came about was that I had been an early member of the chemistry department at Brookhaven National Laboratory and had left there in 1948 to pursue an academic career. When Leonard Olson, the then dean of the college at Oyster Bay, was recruiting, he went to Brookhaven Laboratory, and one of the questions that he asked at Brookhaven was for recommendations concerning someone to come and build a new chemistry department. He happened to speak to Gerhard Friedlander, who was a very dear friend of mine from back in the earliest days of Brookhaven, and Gerhard dropped my name, and the next thing was that Leonard Olson wrote to me. He was very interested in me for one reason that he was very interested in me was that I had recently published a textbook called Principles of Physical Science, which was a text which I wrote jointly with Melba Phillips, then of the University of Chicago, which was a presentation of the fundamentals of the physical sciences for non-science students. It was, so the person that interviewed me primarily was for the position was Leonard Olson, and but of course I came down to Oyster Bay and I met most of the then faculty members, which was a very small group of people after all, and my understanding of the purposes behind the creation of Stony Brook was that Stony Brook was to become a full-scale university. It was made quite clear to me that the mission, the public mission at the time of being a small college for preparation of high school science and mathematics teachers was really a cover for an effort to build something much more substantial and much bigger. And when I came, it was with the full-scale assumption that our mission was to build toward the development of graduate programs and to form an active research-oriented university. So those are the factors that were important in my decision. It seemed to me to be a unique opportunity. I was being asked to come and build a department. It was a unique opportunity to build a new chemistry department from scratch. There was just one faculty member in chemistry there at the time prior to my coming. That was Barry Gordon, who subsequently went to Brookhaven Lab. So it was a unique opportunity to build a new department, which, as I understood it, was to be full-scale graduate department. And went to work in the design of the then-new chemistry building immediately, worked with the architects, and one thing that I'll always remember is that because of the blind of this being a small-scale teacher preparation college, it was necessary to use euphemisms for the designation of research laboratories, so that we designed a building that was full of preparation rooms, and used much imaginative language to actually design research laboratories directly into the building that was under design at the time.
Just a minute there. You had the classrooms on one side of the corridor and labs on the other side?
Yes, we did.
You worked that way. And I think physics did too.
Yes.
Okay.
So I see that the suggested checklist here, and the question was, what was the vision being transformed into reality? Well, that was the vision that I came with. Was this vision of a new university with an opportunity to build a new chemistry department, a graduate PhD granting chemistry department, in a state that did not have a well-developed state university by any means and was long overdue, and a state with substantial resources, so that it certainly looked like something, like a very unique opportunity.
Was Rockefeller governor then, or was Harriman still governor?
Rockefeller was governor.
He was governor then.
1958, yes. I guess he was elected in the fall of 57. I think his term had just begun in 58, because, well, I'm not sure. Maybe wrong about who was governor, because my recollection is now that it was Rockefeller who came to break ground in Stony Brook, but that was not until 1960.
Were you at the groundbreaking?
I was at the groundbreaking.
You remember Rockefeller's speech?
Yes.
Anything he said?
He said that, well, what I was just going to say is that he said, well, here I am inaugurating a Harriman project. So I think it's right. I think when I came in 58, Harriman was governor. Because he said that during the election campaign, he had accused Harriman of going around cutting ribbons on who was governor before Harriman.
Dewey was.
Cutting ribbons on Dewey projects, you know. So here he was about to inaugurate a Harriman project. So that settles the issue. He was very charming. It was a... And there were many school children let out for the day to see the governor, and he had a good repartee going with them. And then he got on a land mover and proceeded to desecrate the land. It was amazing how they, in order to build a few small buildings, they had to actually deforest such a big region. It was the way things were done in those days.
Right. There are pictures of Rockefeller and I think Leland Hayworth at a luncheon at the Three Village Inn at that time. So I think in some way Brookhaven was involved, and I'd like to find out more about that.
I see. Well, I don't know about that. Of course, George Collins was a member of the council. George Collins was then chairman of the accelerator department.
Yeah, right.
At Brookhaven. I had many long conversations with George during the time when I was considering coming. It took me quite a while to make my decision. I had a good job in Cambridge. I was enjoying the industrial research. It was a big change for me, and the economic future up there appeared very bright. So it was quite a while before I made my decision. Then I should insert in here that after I had made my decision and accepted the appointment, that there were some things that happened that gave me very cold feet. And I actually wrote a letter to Leonard Olson withdrawing my acceptance of the appointment. And what it was that was giving me cold feet was, although I had this understanding that I was to be given a mandate to build a chemistry department, the first thing that happened, I think, was I got an inquiry from Dean Olson suggesting that it would be appropriate for me to teach a mathematics course when I came. And So, of course, I didn't feel that would be appropriate at all, either for the students or for me. And this led me to examine in more detail than I had previously what the spirit was and what the practices were. And I found that there was a large group, there was a very substantial proportion of the then Oyster Bay faculty that held this ideal, which apparently came from the University of Chicago program, that teachers should be
Renaissance people.
Renaissance teachers and be able to fill in wherever needed. That there was a positive virtue in that, and that was one of the first. That was one of the first inklings that I had that I might be up against an unusual situation. I came, one of the people that I discussed this with at greatest length and who played a very big role in persuading me to rescind my withdrawal was Cliff Swartz. And there were many discussions with Cliff Swartz and with George Collins at that time. Cliff Swartz was quite convinced that although there were these problems and they bothered him as much as they did me, that this was something that was really going to work and that I should come. So I came in that spirit, understanding that there might be some internal debates about the direction of the institution. If we were going to have an institution that was so focused on undergraduate education that everybody had to be a Renaissance person teaching courses of all varieties, it was going to be difficult to develop an appropriate graduate program with a research component, with the essential research component to go with it. But I took on that challenge, understanding that there might be some clouds over it, at least that there was going to be some clarification is going to have to come.
Did Dean Olson actually talk to you in terms of graduate work?
My recollection is yes.
I see, because that's one. When I came in 62, there was no question but what chemistry and physics were already headed for graduate work.
That's correct, yeah.
And biology was the first department Dave Fox and I just decided that we ought to have outside people come in and check the quality of the faculty and the program and the facilities before we applied to Albany for permission to go into graduate work. The assumption was that the permission had already been given to chemistry and physics when I got there in 62, but not to biology.
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay.
I should now say at this time that I'll take credit for something else that was a very good thing for the university, and that is that after I had made my decision to come to Stony Brook, I received a telephone call from Leonard Eisenbud, who was a friend of mine going back to Oak Ridge days, Oak Ridge National Laboratory before I went to Brookhaven Laboratory. And Leonard Eisenbud called me up and said he'd heard this rumor that I was going to go to some unknown college on Long Island, and he was then at the Bartol Research Foundation in Philadelphia, Swarthmore, Pennsylvania. And what could I tell him about it? I told him about it, and he said, well, he'd really like to consider the possibility of being recruited, and so I put him in touch with Leonard Olson, and the upshot of that was that Leonard Eisenbud arrived at the same time I did. So that was contact through me that brought Leonard here. There was another thing that happened concerning Leonard.
This was 58.
That was 58,
yeah.
Yes. And there was someone else named Joe Silverman, who had known Ed Brookhaven. He was a student of Dick Dodson's, a doctoral student of Dick Dodson's from Columbia, who did his research at Brookhaven. And he was...
Dick Dodson was chairman of chemistry at Brookhaven.
And Joe was then working for an industrial concern. I guess he was part owner of an industrial concern on the island here. And he heard about this, and he was interested. And the upshot of that was that Joe was recruited also. Joe came as an associate professor. I came as full professor. And so we started off in the fall of 58 with a three-man chemistry department, Barry Gordon and Joe Silverman. Just to say what happened to Joe, at the end of 1 year, Joe Silverman had an offer from the University of Maryland, and actually in the chemical engineering department. And so there was some tension in him between applied science and basic science. And he had concluded by that time that this experiment at the State University of New York was not going to work.
So he went to Maryland.
So at the end of 1 year, Joe went to Maryland. So the first year was a time of planning. There was a lot to be done in the building. It was a man named Mike Dolicky who worked with me, with whom I worked. He was an architectural engineer with Voorhees, Walker, Smith, Smith, and Haynes. That was the original architectural firm. And worked with him on the building design. That was a very crucially important matter. And Mike Dolicky was really quite wonderful because...
How do you spell his name?
I think G-O-L-I-C-K-I. Because every time I would say we need a distilled water system in the building, he would put that in and then take it to Elwin Stevens, who was then the principal, that person that the campus had to deal with in the Department of Public Works. There was no State University Construction Fund at the time. Elwin Stevens would X that out, and then Mike Dolicky would come back to me, and I'd get him to put it back in. Mike Dolicky did a really fine job of protecting our interests and seeing to it that the scientific people on campus were being appropriately, the needs were going to be appropriately met. And he himself had some knockdown, drag-out fights with Steve over things like this. But Steve was used to dealing with small college situations.
Yes.
He knew better than if I said we needed a distilled water system in the building. Elwin Stevens knew better. It was that kind of thing.
Well, now he was in the University Architect's Office
or State Architect's Office.
Department of Public Works.
He was with Public
DPW.
Works at that point.
DPW was the agency that built.
Took
care of all state construction.
Yeah,
and it was a very difficult agency to deal with. I mean, that was certainly a great contribution to Rockefeller to create the SUCF.
Yeah.
Now the Stony Brook campus. Well, of course, the Oyster Bay campus was just lovely. It was really beautiful. You know that, Carl. It was a beautiful place to live, wasn't it?
Yeah, it certainly was for 3 years.
So it was. Those first 2 years. Well, the years in Oyster Bay, the first 2 years in particular, developed into a strange kind of nightmare, really, because here we were in these beautiful surroundings. And within the course of those 2 years, 58 to 60, the tension between those of whom I was a strong advocate, who believed that the mission of the university was to develop a university. And there was reason for this in, I guess, the Healy Report.
Yeah.
It was by that time in existence, and the Healy Report had a very clear recommendation on that subject. And there was tension between that point of view and the point of view properly identified with the Chicago College. Substantial number of people, including Leonard Olson himself, who had come from Chicago College. and wanted to build a new Hutchins program on the island.
Well, he came from Albany, but his...
He came from Albany.
Basis was Chicago.
But his education, his orientation in higher education was Chicago College. And then Alan Austell was the dean of students and then kind of a number two henchman for administrator for Leonard Olson. And his orientation was similar program, St. John's in Maryland. I think Alan Austell had come from there.
I'm not sure. I've got it on tape.
But this did develop into a major kind of a battle, and it was at the end of my first year there, in 59, that Leonard Olson, in a very real way, threw down the gauntlet on this issue, because there were three men from Columbia, Ralph Bowen, who was professor of history, Martin Fleischer, assistant professor of political science, and Emmanuel Till, who was assistant professor of history. Those three had all come from Columbia. They were all closely identified with Columbia Western Civilization program and their educational orientation. And they had been there long enough. They'd been there by this time now 2 years, so it was time for them. Nobody came with tenure. I came with a 3-year appointment myself as full professor. And Ralph Bowen had been there as a full professor, but he did not have tenure. So at the end of 2 years, it was time to give them notice about whether they would be reappointed or not. And so late in the summer of 1959, Leonard Olson informed them that they would not be reappointed. They were going to be denied tenure. And this seemed very clearly to be a drawing of lines between the Columbia orientation and the Chicago orientation. I hate to put it in such black and white terms, but that's really the way it emerged, and that's the way it appeared, because they were all... Well, Ralph Bowen was an established person, and that was and Bowen and Fleischer and Chill were both very, very smart. There was no clear reason to deny them at least reappointment. I mean, and perhaps tenure, but there was no reason to deny at least reappointment for an additional term. It was impossible for me to interpret it in any way other than that it was related to the conflict that had developed. Just prior to this announcement, Leonard Olson called me, and he also called Leonard Eisenbud and informed us that we were both being recommended for tenure appointments as of the fall of 1959. So there seemed to be a relationship there, too. So those are the events surrounding that situation. The events and the persons and the experiences are the ones that really stand out in my mind from the Oyster Bay days. However, in that first year, I recruited four faculty members who, all of whom became quite prominent on this campus. My first efforts at recruitment, and the first appointment I succeeded in making was Fausto Ramirez, who was already at that time very well known in organic chemistry. I brought him from Illinois Institute of Technology, and I recruited Bill Lenoble, who has gone on to become a very important organic chemist in this country. And Ted Goldfarb was 24 years old, just completing his PhD with George Pimentel at Berkeley, and we signed him on as well. And then in the summer, when Joe Silverman decided to go to Maryland. There was a vacancy, and it actually was Fausto thought about Say Sujishi, whom he knew from IIT. And so with a burst of last-minute activity, we managed to recruit Say Sujishi. So,
was he an organic chemist?
Inorganic. So we hired one inorganic, one physical, and two organic chemists the first year. So that was that gave us a very solid department, and particularly Fausto's appointment was particularly important in the development of research activity. He came with a couple of postdocs with active research grants, and we were over there in those prefabricated Butler Building laboratories, but we were able to get research space in operation and get research going.
He was very proud that one of his publications was the first one produced by Stony Brook.
He's absolutely right. That was he had every right to be proud of that.
So he apparently was an outstanding person in the field of phosphorus chemistry.
Organophosphorus chemistry is very, very quite preeminent. The enormous publication record.
Yes, right.
And it was the appointment of, I think that the appointment of Fausto was in many ways the making of the department. It was because he was sufficiently well known to give, so that it gave the
set a standard.
It gave out the information of what we were doing in this unknown. That we were actually going serious about building a research oriented graduate department of chemistry, and so the fact that we had made that appointment made a big difference in subsequent recruitment. And for example, Bill Winoble. That was, I think, Bill applied to us after it was known, became known that Fausto was coming, and that was a very important event.
Was he from Illinois?
Bill came here from, he was teaching in a small Catholic college in Illinois. He got his PhD at Chicago. And he'd been a postdoc at Purdue. And then he had gone to industry at Roman Haas in Philadelphia and decided industry was not for him and he wanted an academic job, and he had gone to a small college for a one-year appointment and decided to look for me. Okay. So I think I've answered most of the questions on the suggested checklist.
Okay.
I should say something about my own research activities. I was so busy with the administrative aspects of things that it was not possible for me to set up my own laboratory right away and get things moving in Oyster Bay, as Fausto was able to, and then Bill and others, and Kossauer, and who came in 61, and so on.
Where did Kossauer come from?
University of Wisconsin.
Wisconsin.
But I was very fortunate in having close personal ties at Brookhaven, personal and professional ties at Brookhaven, and I was invited immediately upon arrival to become a research collaborator at Brookhaven, and the association with Brookhaven made a big difference, as it did to the university in general. I think it made a big difference to a lot of people. So for a number of years, I did my research. I set aside a minimum of one day a week to go to spend the full day at Brookhaven, and I worked in collaboration with Oliver Schaefer.
Did you?
At Brookhaven.
Is that right?
Yes.
Goodness.
And I guess I would have to say that I have to take some credit for the subsequent recruitment of Oliver Schaefer to Stony Brook. And as you know, he made a big difference in the development of the Fine Earth and Space Science Department.
Yeah, certainly did. I knew him when I was at Brookhaven.
I'm sure you did. Well, Oliver and I arrived. arrived at Brookhaven actually on the same day, in 1947.
Is that right?
Yes, and we lived near each other and had carpool from Medford.
I arrived September 1st, 47.
Right around when we were.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was with Sam Goldsmith.
Sam Goldsmith.
Yeah, in the same castle with him. Mm-hmm. And Lou Stan.
And Lou Stan, yeah. It was, well, the Brookhaven reminiscences come in here, too.
Right. Yeah. One of the first things I did when I came was to bring or invite Maurice Goldhaber to bring some of the top people out for cocktails at Sunwood to meet two people. I don't know if meet our department chairman.
Uh-huh.
I don't know whether you remember that or not. That was one of the first things I did.
Yeah.
Bring the top people together.
That was in 62?
62, yeah. The fall of 62.
I don't remember that occasion. It's conceivable that I remember that for much of that summer I was in South America with Dick Morris.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We were talking about Dick Morris the other night.
Right.
62, yes. So it may be that I was out of the country when that occasion took place. I should tell a little story about Ward Melville.
All right, good.
You mentioned Ward Melville. Of course, was well aware of his relationship to Stony Brook as our official sugar daddy. And when we were house hunting, we agreed to come, I guess, in January, and then we went through this uncertain time, and it was long about March, I guess it was,
59.
Or maybe even a little later, 58, this
58.
Is. We were seriously house hunting, and this was difficult to do. We had three little kids, and it was difficult to do at long distance from Lexington, Mass., where we were living at the time. But at one point, we found a house in Greenlawn, which was halfway between Stony Brook and Oyster Bay, which is how we had decided to play it. We found a place that we really liked. We really wanted, and that we were put over a barrel by the owner, who required us to get a mortgage commitment in 48 hours or something like that. Something quite difficult to do. And in racking my brains about this, I thought about the person that was friendly to the university that surely had outstanding connections to the banks of the area, and I called from Lexington. I called Leonard Olson and told him that I was in this situation, and asked him whether he thought, at all possible, that Ward Melville might help us out. And he said he thought so. And within the specified time period, we had a commitment from one of the major banks on Long Island. And I subsequently found out what had happened. What happened was that Ward Melville went to Greenland in person, himself, and inspected the house that we were proposing to buy.
All right.
And then called the Security National Bank and told them to make a mortgage commitment.
Very good.
To us. I thought that was amazing.
Yes.
And then I should add a footnote to that, and that is that after when we went to the closing, we did get charged an appraiser's fee.
Well, he had a soft spot for individuals. Ward did.
Yes.
Very definitely. He was a humanitarian in that sense. One-to-one individual.
Yeah.
He and I became, I think, quite close.
A little more questions. Well,
get into the Lee situation at all?
I'll get into the John Lee situation next.
All right.
Chemistry department was flourishing. With those first appointments, we were doing very well. Then in 1960, two junior level appointments were made. Then that was, one was Arthur Lepley, and the other was Robert Schneider. Arthur Lepley left. A few years later, Bob Schneider's still here, as you know.
Is that
Arthur Lepley's father? Value a cooperative inquiry. Edited by Ray Lepley. Was he in Columbia?
Don't think so.
Peoria, Illinois. That's right. I remember Bart Lepley came from, there's a something called Butler University?
Yeah.
In Peoria?
Yes.
Yeah, he was a graduate of that institution. And in 1961, Ed Passauer came. And it was in 1961 that John Lee was appointed. And this came about as a byproduct of the conflict and tension that was building on the Oyster Bay campus. One feature of it was that there was a mandate, a public mandate, by that time, for the university to build a program in engineering. And there was, at that time, only one very junior faculty member in engineering. We had, and by 1961, we had all four classes, freshman, sophomore, junior, and senior classes. Because the ones kids that came in 57 were seniors by that time, so we had, well, by, not by 19, not, not in the winter of 61, but we had juniors, freshmen, sophomores, and juniors, and freshmen are coming in with the promise that they're going to be an engineering program, but Leonard Olson wasn't doing anything about it, and there was only a man named Dick Blasheen. Do you remember Dick?
Vaguely, yes, yeah.
Dick Blasheen was the one engineer, and so some of us got to be extremely concerned about this problem. If they have a public mandate to build an engineering school, why aren't we doing something about recruiting engineering faculty? So what happened was that John Lee came as a candidate for the position of Dean of Engineering. And Leonard Olson recommended to SUNY Central that he be appointed, and I don't recall now who it was attributed to, but I was told at the time that Leonard Olson, that somebody in SUNY Central turned it around on Olson and said, well, if he's that good, if John Lee is that good, then why just Dean of Engineering? Why don't we consider him for president? Did you ever hear anything that said?
I've heard something like that. Whether that came from anyone here in Stony Brook, in other words, that story, or whether it came from Larry Murray, it could very well have come from Larry Murray.
Well, it seemed to us that somebody in Albany was trying to solve the conflict problem here by going over Lenny Olson's head. And this was a way of doing it, was to bring somebody in over him. And John Lee was, well, as it turns out, the sacrificial
yeah. All right.
Buddy for that.
I don't know. I don't
because
I,
it's
I know.
It's certainly clear that it was a surprise to Olson that this happened, and it was a very the appointment of John Lee and the way he himself handled the situation was very polarizing. The appointment itself polarized the faculty. If there was any polarization needed, It carried it about, it carried polarization about as far as it could.
And I saw, if I recall, John came in about January.
61.
And I was one of the people that he consulted with rather closely, regularly, and Sidney Gelber, of course, was another. And Sidney
was chairman of philosophy.
I don't think he was chairman of anything. There was, we had departments only in the sciences. That was something that I think Leonard Olson would prefer not to have been, but he couldn't fight the scientists. He couldn't stamp it out.
Yeah.
But in the, but there was still a divisional structure, and the maximum person was still a divisional chairman.
I see.
And, but in the humanities and social sciences, there were no departments. Mm-hmm. And so Sidney was there as professor of philosophy, I guess.
I think so.
Or he made, it might have, his title might have been professor of humanities. It was, that's the way things were being done.
Well, the
deliberate effort to de-emphasize discipline and departmental structure.
Yeah.
And I think that many, not only Leonard Olson, but many of the, particularly Chicago colleagues, deplored this departmentalization that was happening in the sciences. Leonard, so Sidney was appointed dean. John Lee decided he needed a dean of arts and science to help him come to grips with this situation, and he appointed Sidney Gelber, Dean of Arts and Science.
What was Leonard Olson's position after Lee came?
That's a good question. I really don't recall what he was called. He might have been, I think he may have been called Dean of Faculty. But I'm not sure. But he was number two. And he had a following that's considered this inappropriate. And he himself considered it inappropriate. And it was a very rugged time. It was a very rugged time. And then some moves were made, the appointment of Les Peck, you know, as you know about that. And the denial of tenure to Robert Smolker. These were lightning rod events that increased the polarization. And of course, then we started having this campaign in the newspapers. Well, particularly Newsday.
Yeah. Smolker was from Chicago?
Smolker was from Chicago, I'm not sure, yes.
Yeah.
I think that that wasn't the basis on which the certainly not because he was from Chicago. I mean, that there was a denial of tenure, but in terms of by this time the graduate program development objectives of the institution were openly articulated and was by John Lee. It was not an underground thing anymore at all. And I think the judgment about Bob Smolker was that he didn't have very strong research credentials and that it was necessary for the biology department to build in its research capabilities if we were going to fulfill the mission that was now being articulated. And by this time, we in the chemistry department had developed a PhD program on paper, and we're pushing hard for its approval so that we could begin recruitment for the fall of 1962, which is what we were shooting for.
When did you get your approval?
We got our approval in... We got our approval after John Lee was fired, And it came in a meeting with Tom Hamilton, the president from Albany. What happened was we had our PhD program hours and physics, and if I recall correctly, one or two engineering programs, mechanical and electrical perhaps. Those programs were developed on paper. We had attempted to process them through proper channels to try to get SUNY Central, and then you need State Education Department approval, so that we could go ahead and begin recruitment in the winter of 1961, 61-62. Then John Lee was fired, and a cloud came over the future. I mean, then morale went down to the bottom. Mine certainly did. I didn't know what we were doing there, and what this department that had been recruited by me for purposes of developing a certain kind of institution that was now in question. We didn't know whether it was going to be a graduate and research-oriented university or not, but it looked very much as though it would not be, in view of this public repudiation and humiliation of John Lee, who had been articulating that objective publicly and strongly.
Do you know why he was fired? Why do you think he was fired?